for those who don't know who you are, Neville, or whether they've been living under a rock, but for those who don't know you, you are super successful in terms of business, in terms of property, you know, vast sums of property. You are currently mentoring and helping lots of other people. But I always like to go back to the beginning. Before we hit record earlier on, we'll be talking all things education, and we'll be talking about my son's, you know, process that he's going through at the minute for diagnosis with ADHD.
Yeah.
And your first response was amazing. Right.
Yeah.
I hope he's got it.
Yeah. Education is, I'm all for education. But the proper education, not this education where you find a child who can't do something, so you make them do more of what they can't do.
Yep.
And you punish them because they're useless at doing something. And I always believe that somebody said, I don't know who it was, they said, if you judge a fish on its ability to climb a tree, that they'll feel stupid for the rest of their lives. And that was me. You know, I was a fish and they were judging me on climbing a tree. Well, and so they would say, climb harder, climb faster, you know, do it more, instead of saying, what do you like? And I believe you should teach children on what they do like, what they excel at, and then everything else will drop into place.
See, this is polar opposite to what, not even just in education, even in employment in a lot of places.
Yeah.
What are you not good at? Let's focus on that.
Yeah.
I am a huge believer in what you're saying, and let's double down on your skill set instead. So if you're not very good at this, and you've obviously learned to leverage into outsource, building the businesses that you have done and to double down on what you're doing. Although you're a man of many talents, you know, anyone who watches you on your social media will see that as well as business mentoring and doing huge property deals, you're also, you know, you work on your own houses, you work on development.
I've gone back in the last couple of years, I've gone back to the tools and I've gone back to what I love.
So is that the reason why? It's because it's a passion?
I love doing it because I've got an office in Stamford, in Lincolnshire, and I've got a desk. And I don't think in the last, maybe we moved office in about 2012-13, and I don't think I've sat at that desk more than a couple of hours. I've been in the boardroom, I've had quite a few meetings, but I don't like it. It's not me. I want to physically do some work, and I really, really enjoy doing. Like, so last week I've been painting, I've been tiling, I've been plastering, been doing carpentry, I ended up in A&E because 4 weeks ago I sliced two fingers and wouldn't stop bleeding. So there we are, you know, that's what I do because I want to do it.
Okay, so this is really something that I'd love for people to hear about, because if we go back to the school thing, as much as you kind of brushed over it, you had a really tough time at school.
It was crap. It was an institution where it might as well have been prison, because it was prison for me. And it was prison for a lot of kids. You know, I was just educated in the 50s to be gun fodder for the next war. And that's really what it amounted to. But if you can't spell, then you're caned. You know, if you can't read, you're caned. If you can't, and so therefore, what they're teaching is truancy.
Yeah, teaching you to run away from it.
Yeah,
because, and
then you get so wound up that you can't learn because you're so afraid. And when you get older and you leave school and somebody says, sign your name here, well, you're afraid to, because you can't spell your name. It goes a different, you know, dyslexia for me was every time I blink my eyes, the letters change place.
Just jumbled up.
Jumbled up, yeah. And on my website, NevilleWright.com, there is a dyslexia film from YouTube, and it shows all the letters falling down. And that's Marilyn, my wife, married for 53 years. I've known her 57 years now. And every day I've asked her the same freaking words. how to spell it, three letters at a time. Yeah, over and over and over again. She's just used to it now.
Yeah.
You know, but
that must have been really tough when you were a child, because you were, you know, I've read in your book, you know, horror stories of things that people would never get away with in today's world.
Physical beatings, abuse, verbal.
Yeah. And you can laugh about it now because you've come onto the other side of it. Yeah. You know, if we look at the Neville at school and the Neville of today, you should never be in those terms the person that you've become today. So how does someone with undiagnosed dyslexia, ADHD, challenges around learning, being, you know, drilled down into the you should do this, but you then feeling bad that you can't do it. How did that make you feel?
How does it make me feel? How does it make me feel to move forward and
how
succeed?
Did it make you feel as a child, and then how did you move forward?
Absolutely useless. So he's running away all the time, and hiding, but it made you react, your reactions, so that when you was going to get a slap, you knew, and you was either you run or you ducked, you know. So it was like your reactions are quick, so you make those decisions. And throughout my life, you make decisions quick.
So actually, you found the power, the superpower of that.
Yeah, and that's. It's really interesting because if we just go on how I'm thinking to how I became successful with those problems, it was like, I would say, jump into a swimming pool, breathe out, go to the bottom and stay there until you decide that you've got to breathe. And when you are feeling that anguish and that necessity to breathe, then if you put it into life, if you want something, then if you really, really want to achieve something, you've got to want it as much as you want to breathe. Mm-hmm. And people have a breathing as a normal thing. And they think, well, that's normal. You can breathe. But you stop breathing. And that will show you just how valuable breath is. So if you want to become successful at something, think about that. Do you want to be successful as much as you want to breathe? And if the answer is yes, then you'll do it. You'll be determined. You'll focus. You will have every second of the day focused on that.
It became a laser focus and it became a necessity.
Yeah.
See, I remember watching, I think it was on YouTube, I remember watching it. It was Eric Thomas, who's a very loud, shouty American man. But it was the exact same principle as you've just showcased. When you want to succeed as much as you want to breathe, you're going to make it work. Literal proof of that. I think that very much showcases that it was an all or nothing. You had no choice. Because if we look at it on paper, the Neville in, you know, school in the 50s, you should never have achieved the things that you have achieved today.
No.
What do you think of the traits, as well as that kind of determination? You know, I want it as much as I want to breathe. How much of that was to prove other people wrong? How much of it was for your own success?
Secretly, inside, when I told the Dole office to stick their money up their ass, because I didn't want to leave. I wanted them to give me £2 a week more because I was on the Dole for 3 months. And my mother was feeding my child, and Marilyn's aunt was bringing food around. And I was there, skinny 9 stone, thinking, what about me? I'm starving. You know, I learned a lot about how to survive on there, but I wanted £2 a week to buy some food. And they said, no, you know, if you want to get another £2, you have to get the points. And another point is have another child. And I thought, how crazy is that? Because my mind works in logical ways. I can't afford to feed the one I've got. And you're bloody telling me to get £2 a week extra, I've got to have another child. And that doesn't work out. So I told them, well, I'll look after myself because they couldn't look after me. And I hadn't got a clue of what I was really going to do. And I shot myself in the foot, I thought, because, but then I realized that day before I got home, I was going to burn my bridges and I'm going to be responsible. Because up to the age of 24, you could walk into a job one day, or you could leave a job one day and get another job in the afternoon. It's so easy it was to get jobs. But then in 1974, there was a recession. It all came to a stop. So I had got to be responsible because up to then, it was everybody else's fault. And I'd got nowhere in life. I'd had 18 jobs and got nowhere in life. And it was other people's fault. Why haven't I won the lottery? Why haven't I got more money? Why is it raining today? Everything is somebody else's fault, you know, and I wouldn't stand up and be counted. And that day, I burnt my bridges and said, I'm responsible for everything I do in my life. And I will never go cap in hand to anyone ever again begging. And can you imagine? And for years and years and years, I used to, when things got tough, which was every day, I used to think, oh, what a shit it would be if I walked in that dole office because I'd give up.
Yeah.
And that same lad was there going, come on in, you loser. I knew you would be back.
Because honestly, Neville, there is so much in what you've just said that I want to unpack.
And I couldn't, you know, I couldn't bear the thought.
So there's so much in this because there's so many drivers in there from the poverty trap that the government keep people in.
Yeah.
You can't afford to live right now. You can't afford to eat. I know, let's bring another child into the world who you can't afford to, but we'll give you a little bit more money. But then the £2 or £1 extra wouldn't have gone any further. So that in itself, you know, don't even get me started on that. But then when we couple that with the burning your bridges, you know, some people would have said you cut your nose off to spite your face.
Yeah,
I did. I burned the boats. However, quite often, the greatest successes come when your back is against the wall from a necessity.
Yeah.
You know, but we invest in property, myself and my husband, and we started investing when the boys were 1 and 3.5. And quite often, like, it was tough. We had full-time jobs, so we'll come to that in a minute, but full-time jobs. We were learning to invest in property. We were driving all the way to Peterborough, living in Liverpool. And I'll often get asked, do you wish you'd have done it before you had the kids? And the old me used to go, well, yeah, because it would have been easier. But actually, would we have worked as hard?
No.
Would we have done the like? Because everything in life is just as easy not to do as it is to do. So not the same in so much as burning boats and literally being, you know, on the breadline, definitively.
Yeah.
But the necessity was there. And many times your success has come from perceived failures. So, you know, the tenacity that you've got is absolutely amazing. I love your ability. So I always say that the figures are way skewed. I'll often say that I'm 99% driven by a need to succeed and one by spite for every person who's told me I can't.
Yeah.
It's probably more 50-50 if I'm honest. But I think yours is 90-10 in the other way. 90 to prove all of those people wrong. There must be the biggest sense of success for you and achievement, knowing that many people who've faced similar situations, because guaranteed there will have been other people who were struggling financially to feed themselves during that time frame, who didn't burn the bridges and who didn't burn the boats and kind of got stuck.
Yeah, there was a lot of people that I found along the way that was, shall we say, far better than me in the way of educated. Mm-hmm. They was getting more money. They was they knew far more than I knew. In the retail trade, where to get stuff from, get cheaper. There was far better at negotiation. There was far better at selling. And yet they still had a fear of risking.
Yeah.
So when I was 24, we lived in a 10-foot caravan. 10-foot is about less than this room. And it's about 7 foot wide, and there was Marilyn and myself and a 3-year-old baby, and And it was like, we survived. And people used to say, how is it in that caravan? I go, it's not too bad. We've got running water. And they go, oh, did you plumb it in yourself? And I go, no, it's a condensation that runs, runs down the walls every morning. You know, we were still in the winter of 1973, 74. And it's like, and that told me that if I could survive there and I could survive anywhere, and so therefore, when we started getting some money, it never affected me mm-hmm. in the way of I've got to keep it. We used to spend it on tools, spend it on equipment, reinvest it on more. A different house, you know, used to upgrade on the house or downgrade to upgrade in the future. And so therefore it never affected me. Whereas some people go, yeah, but I need to do this in my business. I go, well, you're all right because you can remortgage your house. And they go, no, I'm not risking it. Well, you took the risk. You took the risk to get the house. You worked your socks off to get the house. Now you've got it. You're now afraid because you've got something and now you're afraid of loss.
So if we're writing, because in my head, I'm already kind of jotting down the how to be successful by a Neville Wright method.
Right.
And in there, so far, I've got discipline and tenacity. You've got no choice but to make it work. In addition to that, there is no fear of risk, calculated risk, and know that there's always an opportunity.
Yeah.
And burn your bridges.
Yeah.
These are three things. So maybe that's what we'll do after the podcast is write the kind of guide to be successful. I mean, you've written the ultimate guide to be successful. And for anyone who is listening or watching who hasn't read Neville's book, the answer is yes. Now, what's the question? I absolutely recommend you read it because we've touched upon the living in a caravan and building success. But if we kind of go back to the beginning, you'd had 18 jobs, which you'd said, you know, openly said, kind of didn't make a success of. The business that you're probably most well known for, although you've got a super successful property business, is Kiddycare. And before we hit record, I actually kind of said I'm sitting across this side of the sofa because I worked for Morrison's in the days when you sold Kiddycare. So you built up Kiddycare from the 1970s from a room.
1977.
From a room in your house?
We bought a terraced house and that was for, we'd got a property maintenance business by then. From 1974 to 77, I'd built up a property maintenance business and there were six people working in that. Mm-hmm. And so Marilyn said, well, I'll come off the tools because Marilyn used to drive the truck and mix concrete and decorate and paint and supply with everybody else. And she said, instead of doing the bookwork at night, and she was also a hairdresser at night, and she also sold turf, you know, on the phone. And so I never got paid for that. Got reported for being a hairdresser for the tax, you know. And she said, anyway, I'll have an office. And it, because we'd started getting contracts from the local authority and stuff like that. And then... before she started the office, we started renovating this house. And she said, I could sell something because in the terraced of houses, people was making offices and shops. Mm-hmm. So she said, we could sell something. Well, what did we know about? Nothing. We didn't know anything about it. So we could have been a estate agent, but not me because I couldn't spell. We could have, and Marilyn was too scared. She wouldn't have gone out to... see houses and people like that because she'd been brought up in a Victorian age of Victorian parents of children should be seen but not heard and good slapping, a good spanking if there was heard. So therefore, at the age of 24, Marilyn wouldn't even answer the telephone, you know, because it was like she'd get told off, you know. It's like, so we came from very different families, but we needed each other to protect each other, you know. So therefore, anyway, we've got a second-hand pram for our baby and a second-hand high chair and a second-hand cot. So we said we'd do second-hand, you know, and nursery equipment.
Yeah.
And there was lots of people in Peterborough did it. There was big shops, the Co-op, Fairways, Alexander Thompson's, and they all did loads and loads of stuff. And we said, well, if they're making a living, and like 12 other people around Peterborough were selling stuff like that, we should be able to make a living, or just a bit of pocket money. And it grew.
See, so, what I love from this, though, is that your perspective of it, and I think this probably goes in the Neville Wright success list, is that many people in business will look at other people and go, well, they're doing this and they're doing this, so they're the competition, so we won't do it. You had a whole different viewpoint, which is, if they're making money from it, if they're doing it, why don't we do that too? Yeah. So from very humble beginnings in the terraced house that you were living in, formed the largest of companies. So Kiddy Care was...
It ended up to be the biggest independent in Europe. So, you know, it's like incredible. From earning like £2 or £3 a week extra or day extra, whatever it was, we sold the first shop in 1980. So, and we moved to a shop 5 times the size. So it was leveraging all the time, because I was leveraging Marilyn's time in the shop because she was going to do the bookwork and she never had time. So she still did the bookwork at night, leveraged my time on a Saturday and in the evenings when we went out and buying secondhand prams. And leveraged my dad and mum's time because they had a flood and they had to come and live with us for 6 weeks. So that was great because we had opened the shop then. They would look after they'd look after Elaine, our first daughter, while we went out buying secondhand prams. Dad would be in the garage cleaning up these prams, you know, ready to open the shop. You leverage people's time, and the leverage of money as well, because we were getting some money from the maintenance business, so we didn't need to get money from the shop. Mm-hmm. And so you leverage these things. And then people, 8 years later, we bought the biggest and the best and the most expensive house in Lincolnshire. And it was like incredible. And people go, how the fuck did you get that? You know, you must have done something really wrong.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the thing is, when they was watching telly, we were working. We were both working, because we was working, making toys for my brother's market stall, my brother's and father-in-law's market stall. So we would work right into the night, into the early hours of the morning. So we'd leverage our time. When people went on holiday, we was working. When people were sleeping, we were working. When I was watching telly, we was working, because we had that drive and determination that all those people who put me down, who put Marilyn down, that secretly there was a determination in our hearts that we would prove. I'm not saying, look, there, I told you so, because they've never told anybody. And we never said it.
Benefit your own knowledge.
That we wasn't the stupid people that people portrayed us, the teachers portrayed us as.
I absolutely love this, Neville. It is a true hero's journey, isn't it? It's not necessarily that, you know, you want to go rub it in people's faces.
No way.
Proving to yourself and to other people that you could actually do it. And I think that's one of the points, is that there's a lot of people who are capable of doing huge things. But, you know, they get complacent. And yeah, I've definitely been guilty of this. Me and my husband have openly kind of just said we work in cycles where we're manic and we're really stressed and we're really busy and we're buying loads of property and I'm doing loads of speaking gigs. And then we kind of go, oh, we need a break. Then the break becomes a rest on your laurels. You get complacent. Yeah. Yeah. Even to this day, you are still always working, always being busy. So how important then is that good work ethic? Because you never stopped and you never have.
Well, I want to keep fit. So I want to drop down dead being fit.
Yeah.
I don't want to be ill, and I don't want to have, I've got grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Yeah, I want to run faster than my great-grandchildren. Yeah, so why not? You know, why not keep fit and healthy? And then one day...
Fall asleep?
Yeah.
Do you know what? I don't think people ever... Because I've listened to so many interviews with you, I've read your book, and I think one thing that runs through as a thread all of the way through is people and the importance of people, the importance you place on people. So I've heard the story about how you went from being, you know, how kiddie care became the discounter it was in the early days from the,
yeah.
because someone came into the shop before it was opened and wanted to buy something.
Yeah, yeah.
So for those people who haven't heard, if someone wanted to come in and buy, they had it was worth £2 and something, £2.40, they had £3 and discount it.
Oh, because we hadn't any change in the till. We hadn't got anything in the till.
Yeah, but never so many people would have said, I'll take the full £3.
Yeah.
Your perspective to give them the discount and that on, you know, turning them a sixpence, that's going to be our business.
You see, making that decision, having the ADHD, making that decision there and then, you see.
Then led to such a huge business.
Yeah.
Not just a business, but effectively a family-run business, but also creative families. One thing that I absolutely adore is you can see how much you adore my brother and she adores you. And I just think the fact that
you can have this
family connection, I absolutely will. She's just a superstar.
Wind her up all the time. Yeah. But,
a marriage that lasted 53 years, working relationships with people, you know, behind the cameras, Barry being super quiet, but been working for you since 1998.
Yeah.
You created bonds with family members all the way through the building of Kiddie Care business.
Yeah.
Customer service and people are all at the heart of it. And I think, you know, I'm constantly banging on about the importance of building good relationships with people and people buying into people. And this, to me, just epitomizes why you've been so successful. Is that you genuinely care for people and that shows through. How did it then feel when you built up Kiddie Care? You come to the conclusion that it was a good time to sell because the offer was really good. How difficult was it to say goodbye to the business?
It was awful because we'd sold 3 Kiddie Cares before that over the years, but that was for a reason. The reason was to expand and to, this was the final thing, but we would leave it in such a way that all the staff was there and our children were there. And so we left it in good hands, but it was awful. It was the worst day of my life, it was, and the worst day of Marilyn's life, you know. And it's, but decisions have to be made. And I look at it like any business or anything. You start at 12 o'clock and you go, and the clock goes round. And there is a certain time where if you reach 12 o'clock again, then it's probably run its course and that's it. So you've got to judge a business, whether it's property, whether it's a retail business, whatever business you're in, you've got to either rejuvenate it or sell it, or sell it and then rejuvenate it, you know, and
which you've done
probably in a marriage, you know, and lots of things. Yeah, it's in everything because, you know, people get complacent, people get exhausted, people get whatever. There's lots and lots of things. So we decided. We had an ambition to take it from 40 million to 200 million. Mm-hmm. And through the recession of 2007, 8, 9, really, really tested our skills on a business. And we went through some horrendous times. We had, we'd lived in a mansion for 26 years, 8,000 square foot, the indoor swimming pool made of marble, you know, which, cost more than like 4 houses in 1982, just a marble swimming pool, you know, and it was like, it was luxury. It was like a hotel grounds.
The house of dreams.
So, and we had to sell that within a week and move out. And
even your ability to do that, so the ability to, when an estate agent is telling you your house is worth this amount and you're saying, I appreciate that, but it's going on the market for lower. That is a true business mind. You've always been able to make decisions quickly. You know, I know they say, what's the phrase? Something like work at speed, repent at leisure, something along those lines.
Yeah, decisions have to be made,
But it's proven right for you time and time again, your ability to move at speed. And those people who kind of sitting in the background going, oh, it was the worst day of your life, Neville, because, you know, you did sell the business for a substantial amount of money, 70 million. You know, I can wipe the tears with 50 pounds. I'm all right.
I know.
But you sold it for it, but it shows the dedication and the
heartfelt it. 2.5 years before that, we owed 14 million pounds and we was losing 250,000 pounds a month because of the recession. You know, and it was like, that was a shit time that was.
I can't even imagine the stress. And we've been through tough times. We've done a, you know, a 49 house purchase of a portfolio and then COVID hit and we had, you know, £2.5 million of lending that was due to be repaid and then the recession hit. And that's nothing in comparison in terms of the numbers that you're talking about. But tough times create tough people.
Yeah.
And time again, you've proven you've bounced back. So you built up Kiddie Care. I was a HR manager at Morrison's when Morrison's purchased Kiddie Care. I've got to ask the question, have you ever regretted it with the demise? Because what you were still on target to turn that business into a 200 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who had the facilities in place, the infrastructure in place, and they were effectively buying it to take over.
Yeah.
And, you know, does it ever feel like they were in the baby? That was your baby, you weren't doing hard?
Yeah.
Was that hard to deal with?
Yeah, it is, because it was, I was called stupid for like all my life, you know, and then I find myself using the same word. Well, that's bloody stupid, that is, because I could have turned around in a week.
Yeah.
Quite easily.
Why do you think they couldn't?
That's a kind of easy to answer, because there was nobody there who owned it.
Mm. No, it was too many chiefs, not enough Indians.
Yeah. Nobody had that passion, that feeling. Nobody was desperate. Nobody was suffocating.
No, I was sat on the bottom of the pool.
Yeah, nobody was there. Yeah, I could have turned it around in a week and they'd have been making amazing profits now. It would.
So it hurts.
I would have loved them to have brought me in right from the start instead of saying, you've got a month to get out of your office and don't talk to anybody. I left our office in 2 weeks. I went across the road. That was the worst thing I could do, go across the road.
You could see it every day.
Yeah. I should have gone away, you know, and then I didn't know what I was going to do. But the thing was, it was easy to turn around and nobody could see it. And that was the dreadful thing about it. And I would have loved to have gone back in and helped them. I would have liked to have helped them right from the start.
Yeah.
But I could have done it, you know, quite easily.
Has there ever been a temptation to do that again, to set up the business again, set up something similar? Obviously, because you moved it online.
No, because, look, we was making, I don't know, 3 million a year. And I can make that doing nothing.
Tell us about what gets you excited now, then. What are you doing now?
Deals.
All the property deals.
Yeah. So, doing deals is good, be able to buy property, turn it around, sell it. And I'm talking about the bigger deals.
Yeah.
And I'm not doing it for myself because I don't need it.
Yeah.
So anything that's accumulated goes on to the next generation and the next generation.
You're always going to be able to outrun.
So I can, So it's not... It's not for me, it's because I want to do it.
Yeah.
You know, I get the buzz. Like tonight, we've got some friends coming around for dinner, but if somebody rings us at 10 or 11 o'clock and says, I've got a deal, I go, we're coming now. Even if we had to get a taxi to go and have a look, we would look. Yeah, because that excitement, that adrenaline.
What keeps that burning inside of you? Because, you know, you could happily retire to any country that you turn
to. Retirement.
I love this.
Right. You see, people can say, why are you not retired? And they go, and I say, well, what is retirement? And they go, do it what you want when you want to do it, you know, and have enough money. So most people want to retire because they don't like what they're doing. I love what I'm doing.
Nothing to run from anymore.
And so therefore, I've had the excitement, I've had the adrenaline rush of every single day of my life. And I don't want that to stop. So therefore, you know, it is exciting because if you see something, a property, and you think I could make that into flats, for instance, or apartments or a commercial, then what you're actually thinking that you're going to give somebody a property to live in, you know, several properties to live in, or a property to have a business. And so therefore you're doing it. You're doing it because you want to create something. You want to preserve something. You want not for people to go, oh, look, Neville, I did that. No, it's for just because you like doing it.
A sense of enjoyment.
Yeah, why do people have hobbies?
That's true. Well, this comes back, I suppose, to what we were saying earlier on in terms of you want to help people. It comes back to the helping people. Lots of people do property deals solely to make money. One thread that's run all the way through everything that we've said is about the people and the helping people. So let's kind of, I know we've come forward, let's go back. Because to get to a portfolio size with 120 million under development and in the pipeline, but it started with very humble beginnings with your first flip. Tell us about the first flip.
Well, I do, a lot of people say, how do I become a billionaire? Well, okay. Why do you want to be a billionaire? Okay. Because I want to retire. Okay, well, okay, so forget about being a billionaire because you never will be one because you want to retire. What about a millionaire? Okay, how do I become a millionaire? The quickest, the fastest way, the easiest way possible. Why do you want the easiest, fastest way? What are you going to do? I'm going to retire. So why do you want? Why don't you just retire? What? And they go, because I haven't got any money. So they want money. I say, but what are you interested in? Well, never mind what I'm interested in. I just want the money.
Baby, we've got the labour pains.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know how you're going to do it. So
so did you always have a passion in property and that's what led to you doing your first
Yeah, I needed to live somewhere.
Necessity, so, again, it's the same thing.
Yeah, I needed to live somewhere. And I thought, this is good. Yeah, because now we've got a roof and four walls, and there were some windows in there, but there was no electricity. There was gas lighting. There was no toilets, things like that. And so we created that, and then it was a terraced house. So then we wanted a front garden. We wanted a garage space because I had to keep moving the car because lorries kept coming down and couldn't get through. So there's a want, and there's a need because when I was on night shift, people would knock on the door and say, hey, can you move your car, mate? Because my lorry is stuck. You know, I mean, it's like things like that. So you think, oh, God, I want to get a place with a garage off the road or a space off the road. Yeah. So it was your wants, your needs, your hopes and your dreams. So all those things, I wanted not to be woken up in the middle of the day because I was working on nights. You see, it's all basic stuff. And that drives you. That drives you. And then what I say is, people, they get so far, and then that's it. They don't want to do any more, and then they're afraid, and they want to keep everything. I forgot the question was.
This is what I love about you.
What's the question?
Your first property and your flip.
Oh yes, right, okay.
Because obviously, when you've
we bought our first property in 1968. For £650. And the reason we bought it for £650, because that's what we'd got. It was advertised for £1,075. And I wasn't brave enough to go into the estate agent. I was 18, I think. Yeah, I wasn't brave enough to go into the estate agent. I was 17, actually. And my father-in-law, he was all right. He was a nutcase, he was. Yeah, he didn't care what he said to people, especially
me. So you leveraged him.
So I leveraged him, yeah. So he went in and he said, I'll give you £650. And the person had obviously died in there and it was an inheritance to somebody who didn't live in Peterborough. So anyway, they took it because it had been on the market for 2 years.
Wow.
So we had that. And then I got my dad, who's a carpenter, and he helped us for 2 years make this house into a house, you know, into a home. And then when we got married in 1970, and then what we did in 1971, A friend of my dad's, they've got a semi-detached house, and they've got a garage space and a front garden, and it was semi-detached where, and I could buy that for £2,000. It was up for £2,400, I think, but they said, because they knew Dad, I could have it for £2,000. And so we sold the one we got for £2,100. But we was going from one that was already done up to one that was, nothing had been done since the 1920s. And we didn't care because we wanted a garage space, we wanted a front garden, and three bedrooms instead of two.
Comes back to need, doesn't it?
So we were prepared to do that work, you know, and then we went on from there. And that's what we did over and over and over again. And before we went self-employed. And then the taxman said, you must have done all this in preparation for being self-employed. Well, we didn't. And it's like, and we want the tax. We go, no, your rules are, if you live in a house for 6 months, you don't have to pay tax on it. But you do if you've got a plan, the intention to build a business. Well, we haven't.
We were just living in the house as an upgrade.
Exactly. Yeah. So we had to prove that was the situation. But again, we had a four bedroom. We ended up in a four bedroom bungalow, and we went to a three bedroom semi detached. This was a detached bungalow, three bedroom semi detached. And everybody goes, "Why have you done that?" Because you're living in a really nice place, a big bungalow. Well, we couldn't afford the heating, and it was dreadful, you know, and it was out cold, and we wanted to go into a smaller place, which give us more money for investment. On more property.
So this is something that you've always done, is reinvest.
Yeah, go back in some people's eyes, but to go forward at a much bigger...
Well, you've done that a few times as well.
We have.
You've done that where you've sold, you know, the huge 8-bed, 8-bath model swimming pool. And from there, you ended up in the next place you lived after selling that up during the recession. Was that when you moved into the caravan?
No, we went into our office for two and a half years.
To your office?
Then we moved here.
Down and up. Yeah. I think what sets you apart from so many people is that you're willing to do whatever it takes. And not just you.
I've seen so many people who are not willing, and they've gone bankrupt and lost everything. Mm. And so you've got to be in front of the curve all the time. Whichever way you're going, you've got to be in front of the curve. Going down, you've got to be in front of the curve. You have. And
how much of that is timing and how much of that is an appetite for risk? Because you're willing to take the risks, knowing that there's something greater on the other side.
Well, we've seen people, when we bought that house in 1982, the people had sat on it. It went bankrupt. So they sat on it too long, and we bought it off the bank. Mm-hmm. And it was, we realized that we was going to be in the same position, like in 2009, we'd be in the same position. So everything goes around. So I didn't want to hang on to that and have the house taken away from us. I wanted to sell it first. And I realized as well, we've got 125 staff full-time and I doubt if any of them would want to go self-employed, and they got families, you know, and they loved what they were doing. We could start window cleaning again. You know, we could go into a temporary caravan and live quite easy and start a window cleaning business. We didn't want to do that. You know, we didn't want all the 125 people to be out of work.
So we
sold that house within a week.
There were so few people who would do what you did, who would make what are deemed massive sacrifices. And the same thread keeps coming through. You are one of the most humble people I have ever met. That you were willing to sell your huge house, downsizing, having, you know, you're learning from other people's mistakes. They being forced into receivership, you bought the house from the bank. I don't want to be there again. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. Many people would bury their head in the sand. You're willing to sell it in a week at effectively much lower price point than you were recommended by the estate agents, because at the back of your mind, there's 125 staff and all of their families.
There's about 500,000 less. And also, I've got a £3 million pension, which we managed to get all £3 million out of it. We did, and put it into the business. So
and there goes the point again. We took the £3 million out. How many people would go, sod this, it's been tough going. Yeah. We're going to move on. It all got
better. But also, you know, there was that thought of, it will come right. It will, you know, just get... In my book, I was standing next to a fruit machine, and it was like it was dreadful days. It was like it felt like you're putting £5,000 in every few minutes into this one-armed bandit, and you knew there was the prize there.
Jackpot's coming.
But you didn't know how much money it would take to put in to get the jackpot out. You knew it was there, but would the money run out? Before
you actually hit the jackpot.
Yeah.
So you've always had a decent appetite for risk. What would you say? Because I always like to give people a lesson or a learning.
Yeah.
There's tons of lessons in what you've already said. We're creating this list of the Neville Wright list of success. For many people who would now say that we're facing a recession or we're hitting some hard times and there's going to be discounts on properties, but there's also, you know, the flip side to that, many people's businesses are going to struggle or people will struggle financially. For anyone who is those days where it is, excuse my French, but shit or bust, what advice would you give? We've got Drive, we've got Tenacity. If someone was starting fresh today, what advice would you give to them?
What do you mean? Just starting
fresh in business, whether it be because they faced already hardship, bankruptcy, failure, or whether they're just starting brand new in business?
Well, don't be afraid, because it's like, people stand on the edge of a swimming pool and they're afraid to dive in because the water's cold. But when you get into that water, you know, you're acclimatized to it. And it's like, if you're going to, how do you know the grass is greener on the other side? Well, you've got to get out there and have a look. You've got to go over that mountain. And if it is, you've got to be hurting, really, to actually make that move, because if it is so bad where you are, then it's not going to be any worse where you're going.
What an outlook. It's, you know, what's the worst that can happen? Because you've had the highs, you've had the lows, you've got, you know, a beautiful family and a beautiful house right now. What excites you right now? What's next on the plan for you, therefore?
Well, I keep suggesting to Marilyn what we should do, and she keeps saying no. who knows? Well,
I need to
write another book, which I got halfway through, about education, and then I stopped it because there's too much to do. Every minute of every day is taken up with things that I want to do, and I would say to people, follow what you are interested in. Follow, and don't wait until the right thing comes along. Go and do something. Do it. And you find these, especially young people, they have a year off where they've been to university and learned what, you know. I can understand people go to university if they've got a career.
Yeah.
Thing in mind. But people go because they're afraid of leaving school. They're afraid of leaving their mates. They want to be they're in the comfort zone. They've never had a job in their life. They've never had a newspaper round. They've never had a milk round. They've never done things. So therefore, it is getting worse and worse. And the older they get, the worse it gets. And they need to get out and just go and knock on the first door and say, "Give us a job," you know, and learn these things. Because they're dropping behind all the time. They're dropping behind. And I'm rambling now.
I could listen to you all day. Neville, yeah. I'll do a couple more. So I need to know what it is. You keep telling Marilyn that you need to do something, but she says no. What is it? What do you want to do?
Yeah, well, I'm looking for another house.
For you to move into?
Yeah. So my dream, I mean, we can sit... The other house, what we've got at the moment, we can see the sea, but I want to be on the sea. I want to be on it, you know. But I don't want to be on the sea and the... I want to be on the beach. Yeah. I want to live on the beach.
Nice. What might want to be telling this now?
Too much sand coming into the house.
What a first world problem.
The wind will blow the sand into the house. Yeah, well, don't...
How will we manage?
Don't have carpets. Yeah, have a stone floor. Yeah. I'd like to kind of go back to just like nature.
Yeah.
I would. But there's obviously some discussion there.
I like that word.
You can go and live like that if you want.
While I stay, yeah, okay. So you've been told, basically.
Yeah. So, you know, it's just...
I love your outlook on life. I think you're one of the most humble, but also one of the most happy people. And I think there's a lot that can be said for living a happy life, irrespective of your circumstances. You've lived a happy life in the highs and the lows. You've got a phenomenal outlook on life.
You've got to have your goals. And one of the first things to say is your 50-year goal. Well, I'm 73. I'll be 123. Right, okay. So we'll have a 25-year goal, you know, to reach nearly 100.
House on the beach.
Yeah, but then you've got, you know, your health goals and you've got your goals with your partners. You've got your family goals. And then, you know, you break it down. You've got your yearly goals, your monthly goals, your daily goals, or weekly goals.
You still do all this.
And your minute-to-minute. I work on minute-to-minute goals. Like from 7 o'clock this morning, you know, I've been on different sites. I've been doing different things. Been mentoring, and you work on that kind of goal. I work backwards. So Marilyn says, are you ready? Are you ready to go? No, because it'll take me 15 minutes to get there. You know, take me 4 minutes to get the car out. It'll take me 3 minutes to lock up. It would take me 10 minutes to have a shower. I'll work it backwards.
What is the one question that no one's ever asked that you'd love to be asked? Or what is the subject matter that nobody ever discusses with you that you're really interested in?
Well, nobody discusses money very often. Nobody comes and says, how much do you earn? You know, or what do you do?
Do you think that's because we're very British and it's uncouth, we don't ask?
Well, because I would think that people would want to know because... then they can set their goals.
I am certain our listeners will want to know, so I'll be the person to ask.
Yeah.
How much do you earn and what should they be setting their goals for?
I would think average between 5 and 10 million a year. Could be more, but it depends on what deals.
Because you always reinvest it.
Yeah, and then it could be more because I'm not to the investment sector. Anyway, I'm talking about flipping and doing deals. But I don't look at it as my money.
Yep.
And never have because we was just a sole trader up until 2011, was a sole trader, not even limited. And when the Morrisons bought it, they said, Kitty Care Limited.
You had to convert.
No, we had to go onto a company, we had to form a company called Guayco Limited for about 24 hours so that we could sell it. You know, it's just like, what?
No one can believe it.
Yeah, no one can believe it. Yeah. So they don't, and they don't ask why. Why? Why do you do it? What do you get out of it? What do you, everybody seems to think about money, but there's no ceiling to money, you know, in way of investment and what you can do with it and the passion and that you need.
Do you think that's why you've always been able to replicate it and always make more, is because you don't have a scarcity mindset around it? You're not fearful of losing it?
No, because the caravan and the window cleaning set a standard. My dad said to me when I first went into our house, that £650 house, Neville, you're lowering your standards. You're lowering your standards. I said, what do you mean? Well, we lived in a detached bungalow. I said, Dad, that you have a standard of a nice detached bungalow in a nice area. And he lived in there for, I don't know, 40 years, something like that. But I said, I haven't got a standard. I've got to find my standard. And I'm not dropping, so I'm not dropping a standard. You have a standard. I haven't got one. I need to find it. But I said, but when you started that, did you not rent rooms? You told me you rented rooms. And he said, yeah, I did. I said, well, I'm not renting a room. I'm buying a bloody house. You know, so that was, my mentality was a little bit different. I couldn't get that. So I was brought up in a different mentality, but so I didn't have a standard. So I made my standard and I accepted my standard that I was happy to be alive and live in that, and I could make a bucket of soup for 20 pence or whatever, you know, out of scraps. And so they give you a skill set, and they don't teach survival in schools, and they need to teach survival, you know, and their money and that life is not all about getting a job and being secure and working from 9 to 5, because people go, well, you work all hours. So yeah, because it isn't there all hours, you know, there's 24 hours in a day. Why don't you use them? Why don't you use every hour that you can possibly use?
I think there's so much that people can learn from this. And I completely agree. And I would love to sit down, and maybe we should book another one to sit down and talk all about education. I've got a 13-year-old who is currently running his own little business.
Good.
She's done off his own back. He is buying and selling clothes, secondhand clothes.
Yeah. Nice one. Good.
I went home a couple of days ago and he's had these business cards printed with his little logo on. He's had his own business. They cost him £5, but he can reinvest it to buy his own cards. Yeah. He's putting them in with the parcels, which say, thank you for your customer. Follow me on my Instagram page.
Nice.
And I've got to say, there's something that I think you'll really love, and it's probably a good point for us to then say, well, we're going to record something about the education system. The reason being, and I hope his teachers aren't listening, he said, I said, what, he's going to year 9. He's going to choose his subjects. So he's going to decide on what his options are going to be for doing his GCSEs. And he said, well, I was thinking of doing a business because I want to move into business. But how many business teachers actually have their own business? My business teacher drives a Honda Civic and I want better than that. And I thought, I can't even argue with that boy, because he's absolutely right. I went to university, I studied business, and not one person in my university and the lecturing team had their own business outside of that. They were in jobs.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hit record on another one. We'll talk all about the education system. You can tell us all about what's going to be in your book so that people can listen to that one. I want to say a huge thank you for not only investing your time today, but bringing me wine, inviting me into your home. And for anybody who is listening or watching who wants to follow more, NellWright.com is the place to find all of your information. Yeah. And if you haven't read the book already, all of the proceeds go to charity.
They do. Yeah, I help 24,000 startup businesses all over the world.
Phenomenal. So the book is called The Answer Is Yes. Now, what's the question? So everyone should watch the YouTube channels, all of the information on there on NellWright.com, and go and buy that book. Thank you so much for your time, Evan.
Thank you.